The Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies presents the Pearl of Great Price Lecture Series, given by Dr. Hugh Nibley. Today's lecture is entitled Joseph Smith Matthew.
The Lord is going to tell you it's apocalyptic, what's going to happen to the world. The 23rd chapter, the one preceding, notice the Joseph Smith one is quite different. The verses are arranged differently, and that's for a very good reason. He talks about the loss of the gospel, the falling away and so forth, your numbers of times when it comes. This is a thing, of course, which the later church would not tolerate, the idea that it had got lost, that there was a gap. But anything, the Lord had brought it, he'd saved us, and now it's the triumphant march of the church, and the human race is saved, and that takes care of that. They did not like to admit the gap. They did not like to admit that he would come more than once. That was known as chiliasm, and that was absolutely out. In fact, 400,000 Donatists were slaughtered in North Africa with the approval of St. Augustine because they preached that there would be a millennium. The Lord would come again. That's chiliasm. Chili is the Greek for thousand, you see. And if you believed that sort of thing, you were out. So the verses had to be rearranged to make only one coming of Christ, and that's why things all mixed up, and it is such a mess, nobody can make any sense of it now. And for that reason, as a matter of fact, in the Catholic Church, this is not recommended. In fact, it's not permitted as a subject for sermons. You can't give a sermon on this because it's so confused, and you might lead people astray and so forth. I have some interesting documents on that. We won't refer to this here. But here we have in the 23rd chapter of Matthew the preceding. The Lord sums up his dispensation. Maybe it's the temple, Easter time, and they're there for the Passover, and he gives this great sermon in the temple, and as he leaves the temple, then the apostles come with the question, Matthew 24. But notice the situation here in Matthew 23. The dispensation has rejected the message, absolutely and completely. The very people that should have accepted it are the ones who have scorned it and rejected it and caused all the others to reject it as well. And he repeats, how many times does he repeat here? Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Then, 15th verse, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Woe unto you, 23rd verse, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Woe unto you, 27th verse, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. And 29th verse, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. So that's the refrain. The scribes, of course, those that study the scripture, and he starts out by saying, they sit on to the people, he's talking to the people, they sit on Moses' seat, and you hearken to them, hearken to what they say, because they preach the gospel. They are the very people that should be most welcome, ready to welcome the Messiah. The scribes, we mentioned the Sopharim before, those who study the scripture and who teach it. And the Pharisees are the Parisi, those who are set apart. Paresa means to set apart, our word part, you see, pares, part, set apart, meaning consecrated. Meaning chosen, meaning sanctified. These are the ones, they regard themselves especially pure. The scribes and the Pharisees are the ones who should lead. They should be the ones expecting the Messiah and the first to welcome him. And they were the only ones who didn't. They would have absolutely nothing to do with him, and they turned the people away from him. So he goes down the list. We don't want to linger on it here, but it's very much to the point here. I'm 24 again. Where I say he repeats that refrain. So skinny. Come on, this old Nestle edition, it's very hard to find things. Here we are. Yes, then Jesus spoke to all the people, to the multitude, and to his own disciples, and he says, these men here sit on Moses' seat. I mean, the scribes and Pharisees. Do everything they tell you to do, but don't do the way they do. Kata erga avton mepoeta, but don't do their works. Legusingar kai upoisin, because they do and they don't say. So every time after this, he refers to them as hypocrites. Hypocrite, simply the Greek word for actor. An actor, a person who's playing a role which is not his real role, who's pretending to be somebody he isn't. And every time he refers to them on that grounds. They play a good role, they talk a good talk, but they're hypocritical about it. And they do all these things simply for appearance, prostatha theathenai, purely for appearances. Appearances, it's fine, you can keep it up. And he goes down the list of various things about them, the scribes and Pharisees, the sanctified and so forth. Title, rank, office, and authority count for everything, he says, among them. The authorities are the great obstacle instead of the great aid to the progress. They're the great obstacle to it. They're crazy about statistics, he says in the 15th verse. The temple is merely a matter of statistics with them. They're wholly engrossed in business, the accounting, the record. Remember the mint and the rue and the tithes and the tax. They're so minute and careful about keeping the records, but they ignore the main law. But he says, that's important. This you should do, but you should not neglect the other, and they simply reverse things. They're blind leaders of the blind. Three times he calls them blind leaders here. They don't know where they're going themselves. So he says they're very careful. Administration is great with them, and administration is important, but they've completely inverted the values, he says in the 24th verse. They have exploited their position. They seem very sincere and are very impressive. 28th verse, but they're false and unscrupulous. They identify themselves with the prophets, the founding fathers. From the beginning, though, the true messengers have been rejected and thrown out from the beginning in every other dispensation, he says, from Abel on down. That has been the way it's gone. See, his dispensation has fared no better than the others. When the Messiah finally came, the dispensation, they will certainly accept him this time, but how did they treat the son of the Lord of the house? They treated him worse than any of the others had been treated. Remember the parable on that subject. So, Jerusalem, then, the famous saying, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, 37th verse, how often would I have gathered you under my wing as a bird gathers her, Cornelius' word, it used bird, not hen, as a bird gathers her chicks, but you didn't want it. So, you've rejected me, and so the next verse he says, so it's all over. This is the last chance you're going to have, he says. So now you are finished, he says in the 38th verse. I won't bother you again. Now, Joseph Smith's story begins here with the edit, with this different verse arrangement and so forth. You notice the first verse of the Joseph Smith text is the 39th verse of the 23rd one. This is where Jesus comes in. Because what happened here, he's never talked as strongly as this before. It's his final, his farewell. He knows he's going to be crucified and so forth. And he said astonishing things. This is very strong against the scribes and Pharisees and so forth. And the apostles are really upset. They're worried about him. They come to him, it says secretly, embarrassed, and ask him, Lord, just what will happen? What is going to happen? And this is what he tells them. This is how it happens. This is the pattern that is laid down here. So this is very important in our list of dispensations, because this is the dispensation of the meridian of times, the most important of them all. Now, he tells them, as did Enoch, about the three times of wickedness and vengeance. First, what will become of the Jews? What will become of the Christians? And then what will become in the next dispensation? He talks about the restoration and what's going to happen then about our own dispensation. So that brings us right down to date. So we begin verses 1 to 20, and they deal with the end of Jerusalem. What's going to happen to the Jews, the fate of them? But notice the verses are different here. Our verse 2 is verse 1, and I have underlined here in red all the words that are not found in our Matthew, in our text, which makes a great deal of difference. They're hollow without, and they become extremely perplexing, but when you realize what he's talking about in this first verse, he says, you'll never see me again. This is the last you'll see me until I come again. And then the Lord says here, all this one says, all the King James said, well, all the Greek text says is, I will not come again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. What did he mean by that? Say unto you that ye shall not see me henceforth, and know that I am he of whom it is written by the prophets. They had rejected him. Then until ye shall see, blessed he who comes in the name of the Lord, in the clouds of heaven, and all the holy angels with him. Then understood his disciples that he should come again on the earth, after he was glorified and crowned on the right hand of God. Remember when he came to the Nephites, in the Christian record, in the New Testament, he appears 27 times after the resurrection. The resurrection wasn't the last time he appeared. But when he appears to the Nephites, remember, he's accompanied by angels. And in the 17th chapter of Nephi, 24th, he comes down with, he appears accompanied, but until I come again. Well, they didn't like that, and so they just rubbed that verse out, that until I come again, because as I say, they didn't believe he was to come again. St. Augustine, to say, to think he would come again is an insult to the church, because after all, didn't he come and found it? Where are we if we need him to come again? And the idea of restoration, until very recently, now everybody's talking about it. The idea of restoring the gospel they considered quite insulting. Don't we have the gospel? Wasn't it given to us? So we start out, Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and then his disciples came to him. And they said, what about the buildings? As they went through the temple, they come in. There was lots of building activity going on at that time. And they were asking about what's going to happen here. Show us concerning the buildings of the temple. Thou hast said, they shall be thrown down, and left unto you desolate. That's not in the King James, that part is it. And Jesus said unto them, see ye not these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be. Now that's the King James. But here he says, see ye not these things, and don't you understand them? As it was in all the prophets. Do you not understand them? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here upon this temple. That's what they're talking about specifically, because that being left out in the third verse, that being left out, great argument as to what he was talking about. One stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And then it says, and this is very important, the fourth verse, it says, Jesus left them and went up upon the Mount of Olives, because somehow, puzzlingly, the next verse says in the King James that they come to him when he's on the Mount of Olives. Well, they were just leaving the temple in this conversation. And the next thing but here it says, they came to him when he was on the Mount of Olives, and they came to him, as it says here, privately. Each one wanted to know for himself. They wanted to keep this thing. They're puzzled by it. See, what's really going to happen? Will you please tell us? Can you let us know, he asks. Tell us, when shall these things be, which thou hast said concerning the destruction of the temple and of the Jews? Notice in this verse 4. This is the first destruction he's talking about after his own time, the destruction of the Jews, the temple and the Jews. Notice that and the Jews, temple and the Jews, is not in the King James Version. And what is the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now, the end of the world is mentioned 3 times here, and each time it specifies what it means by the end of the world. King James simply says, end of the world. Well, you say, well, that's the end of everything. Everything just passes away. Everything is vaporized. There's no universe. There's nothing. No, that's not it at all. So it says here, and the end of the world, or the destruction of the wicked, which is the end of the world. That's what we mean by it. That is the perennial question. They're always asking that. Right through the Middle Ages, the year 1000 became a year of great panic and so forth, because it said it's the end of the world, all things will end and so forth. Time and again that has appeared, but especially in the year 1000. Who was the, not Rodicanaci, but a Romanian scholar wrote a book on that, on the year 1000. What was his name? But in the Chronicles, in Glauber's Chronicle and other chronicles, in the English Chronicles, the year 1000 was a time of panic and alarm because they thought everything would come to an end again and again. But what do you mean by the end of the world? This is what you mean. The destruction of the wicked, which is the end of the world. And then this comes in. He's going to give it in chronological order. Now, again, it's very important for him to say, take heed that no man deceive you, because this subject was more argued about than any other subject throughout the centuries to follow. When is the end of the world? When is the Lord coming? What's going on here? So the Lord says, you must get this straight here. It's very important. And what he gives us in Matthew here is a very confused document that makes nothing clear, and decide people that we'll just leave that alone. But take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come. Now we come in chronological order. First, many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and deceive many. Now this is Christ the Messiah. You see, other false messiahs came as Christ. There was, right at the time, immediately after Christ, and during this very time, this is what the Jews do to the apostles, they shall deliver you to be afflicted and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Now this is the ninth verse, or it is the seventh verse here, but it's the ninth verse in the King James Version. The verses are going to be moved around here. They shall say, I am the Messiah and deceive many. Well, who came? Well, there was Hanan, Hanavela, who means the hidden one, Hanavela, Hanan Hanavela. He had a career in Babylon as a clerk, and he came to Jerusalem and ingratiated himself with the scribes and Pharisees, with the high authorities in the temple and so forth, and started giving out that he was the hidden one, that he was the Messiah, and people started following him already at this time. And then there was Elkesai and Honi, who spent 70 years in a cave and gave out that he was the Messiah. And everyone was asking, Josephus says, in that day, where is the Holy One? When will he come? And so forth. Everyone was looking for him, so that Herod claimed to be the Messiah, as a matter of fact. Herod Agrippa claimed that very thing. And his brother Pheraus put it in his mind. His brother Pheraus was the one who first put forth the claim that he was actually Messiah. And he promoted a Persian by the name of Bagoas, who was a Carian eunuch who claimed to be the Messiah. I say, Brother Welch has my 2 big volumes of Eisler out on that subject. Robert Eisler wrote a huge work on this, all the false messiahs in the time of Christ. The woods were crawling with them. Many, many have claimed. And it was no crime to claim that you were a messiah at the time of the Passover, because who would know which was? When the Messiah came, he was not going to be recognized by many. So it was no crime for the Lord to say he was the king of the Jews. Many people claimed that and got away with it. Well, but this is the condition you find in Josephus, the description of what follows immediately after the crucifixion. It becomes all hell, just like it is in the Middle East today. Then they shall be offended and betray one another. Everyone becomes offended here, and here we have a blank, blank, blank. And then many false prophets shall arise and deceive many, is what we were talking about, and they did. In this time of stress and Ben-Yohai, all kinds of stress and hysteria. And because iniquity, what happens? The usual reaction. Shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. It's everyone out for himself, and everyone is desperate. And iniquity abounds, and the love of many waxes cold. But he that now remaineth steadfast and is not overcome, the same shall be saved. Again, remaineth steadfast and is not overcome, that is not in the King James. They'll be martyred, they expect to be, as far as that was concerned. Now, this is his instructions for the Jews, what's going to happen for that time, for the people living at that time. Matthew 24, this is the 15th verse, and here it's the 12th. When therefore you shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel, that's Horma or Harabah, Herev. Horma is abomination, desolation. See, the land desolation was a land that had been destroyed by an enemy and was cursed and could not be inhabited again and so forth. The land Horma, desolation. It figures in the Milchama, in the battle scroll, and in the same way it does in the Book of Mormon, where they use desolation the same way. Bountiful is the other side. See, there was the Dar al-Harab. Harab is Herev. That means desolation, see. It's also the Arabic word for war. And the Dar al-Islam, the land which is saved, the land which is submitted. Those two parts of the world, you're either in Dar al-Islam, and the Roman Agar Pacatus, the peaceful world, or Agar Hosticus, or the hostile world. And the abomination of desolations is the one, of course, who is on the other side and who will take over. Of course, time and again, Israel was occupied, taken over completely by great powers, which were utterly destroyed, wiped out. I mean, when it was destroyed, I mean they destroyed almost as thoroughly as we can do today. They can't touch our techniques anymore, but they were thorough about it because they had plenty of time to work on it. Well, anyway, concerning the destruction of Jerusalem, then you shall stand in the holy place. Whoso readeth this shall understand, and this is secrecy. Let them who are in Judea, no specifically, that's where Jerusalem was, these were the Jews, this was the kingdom of Judea. What do? You do every time Jerusalem is seized, what do? The place is surrounded by hundreds and thousands of caves and mountains. The deep gorges there, that's where the Dead Sea Scrolls found several hundred caves. And you notice those gorges, Wadi Haver, Nath Haver, and Qumran, all those places. The huge cave, the Mutaraba cave, the great cave in which so many documents were found, quite near Jerusalem. Nobody even knew it was there, and it was packed with documents. I mean, all these things had been so near to Jerusalem all this time, nobody knew about it. Well, you flee to the caves is what you do. It's the safe thing to do, and you hide out till it gets over, just as Lot did, just as when he escaped from Sodom and Gomorrah at that time of great destruction. And so you shall stand in the holy place. Let them who are in Judea flee to the mountains. And when you're on the housetop, you flee. But this time, you don't return to take anything with you. You're not coming back this time. We have some wonderful letters. I said that Nahal Kever, that's right behind Ein Gedi. There's this gorge, it's steeper than Rock Canyon here up the sides, and the Arabs climb up, barefoot Arabs climb up the cliffs there and discover these caves full of documents. The Cave of Records is up there of the time the people left Jerusalem as destruction at the time of Christ. They went up there and hid out there and died in the caves. They couldn't get out. The Romans camped on the hills above them, watched everything they did, and not on the opposite cliff, on the opposite side of the valley, didn't make any effort to get to them. And they tried to get out by night down these very dangerous paths and so forth. They buried their records deep and deep in the dust in that cave, hundreds of documents describing one that is particularly interesting because it's a deed to a farm owned by a man called Alma, the son of Judah, A-L-M-A, Alma. We've always laughed at that name before, but this man's name was Alma, the son of Judah. And there's that deed. The first thing you see on your left-hand side as you enter in the House of Records there, House of the Scrolls, they call it, the Shrine of the Scrolls, with a light behind it shining through the parchment, is this deed to a farm owned by Alma, the son of Judah. They left all their farms and everything. One very rich woman, she thought she'd make it to Egypt. They were trying to get out treaties, same times and same ways in the Book of Mormon, fleeing to Egypt, you see, in the time of Lehi. They couldn't make it, they died up there. Tremendous tragedy going on, but the record is very moving. So this is what's going to happen. Don't return to take anything out of your house. Don't go back for a watermelon, it won't do any good. And if you're in the field, don't turn back at all, because there's no point to going back at all. Don't go back to town once the city's been taken. It's not going to be freed again. Neither let him who is in the field turn back to take his clothes. Just go. And this sounds like a cry of woe and a threat, even gloating, but it isn't. It's a fair warning. See, the Lord is telling them ahead of time. Woe to them that are with child, unto them that give suck in those days. Make sure that you won't have to leave in a time of pregnancy. Well, make sure you don't have to be there in the same way. Therefore, pray that the Lord, that your flight be not in winter, neither on the Sabbath. Arrange things so that you won't have to flee in winter. Look forward to it. But I'm giving a fair warning. Winter time, and there's no time for pregnancies or no time for women, winter. So it's giving a fair warning. So you can make your proper arrangements and prepare. But this is the way you do. You knew what the Jews have always done, see. They did it in, incidentally, these caves of the scrolls, they go clear back, some of them, to the first kingdom of Egypt. They've been hiding out in those caves for 3,000 years. Every time it was invaded, they'd go, they knew these caves, they'd go to them. Fleeing to the mountains is what they did. And it was routine. So that's what the Lord tells them to do now, but don't come back this time. And for this is the worst that has ever happened or ever will happen to the Jews, and of course it was. They became a non-people for 2,000 years after that. They became nothing. They're completely dissolved. For in those days shall be great tribulation on the Jews and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Notice he's talking about that destruction. The destruction is to take place that time, not the apostasy. Such as was not before sent upon Israel of God since the beginning of their kingdom. All this is supplied in Joseph, and it's very necessary to have. Until this time, nor ever shall be sent again upon Israel. And of course, it lasted, I'd say, for 2,000 years. And because it says here, in the 19th verse, all things which have befallen them are only the beginning of sorrows which shall come upon them. Now, the King James simply says, these are only the beginning of sorrows. But all these things are only, and it was. The fall of Jerusalem, the driving out of the Jews, was to go in sustained misery for the next 2,000 years. They had no citizenship, no rights anywhere. And, you know, pogroms and everything else, everywhere all the time. And so this was the worst. There could never be anything worse than that. And it was. Well, why didn't it wipe the Jews out? It so very nearly did. Look at the Holocaust. That wasn't the only Holocaust. There were many of them. 1648, the tremendous Holocaust under the Hetman Chmielnicki. Yes, the Polish Hetman, well, he was really not a Polish Hetman. He was trying to overthrow the Polish government. But he wiped out the Jews of Poland in the great pogrom of 1648. This was happening. Well, why weren't they wiped out? He says, just for this reason. I've cut it short. They would have been, he says. And except those days should be shortened, there should be none of their flesh saved. Again, you notice, Joseph Smith adds very valuable notes here. Except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh saved. No, none of their flesh saved. The Jews wouldn't survive unless their captivity was shortened. But for the elect's sake, for the righteous among them, according to the covenant, those days shall be shortened. King James says only, for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. But it's because of the covenant he made with the fathers. Of course, it didn't. Well, for example, in the book of Enoch, you saw that he covenanted with Noah that his seed should be on earth to the end, his descendants should be to the end. Well, now, and he makes it very clear in the 21st verse, and this looks rather puzzling because this stands in the King James this way. Behold, these things I have spoken unto you concerning the Jews. That's what I'm talking about now, the Jews. And again, after the tribulation of those days, which shall come upon Jerusalem, he's talking about that particular Jews, if any man shall say, now then there's going to be the Christians, they're in for it now, then there'll be false Christs come, and they were a dime a dozen. They came out, well, of course, this is the whole Gnostic movement. The whole second century is the century of heresy. And Ephremius lists some 88 different heresies, Gnostic and otherwise, led by men like Valentinus and Marcus and so forth, who pretended to be the Messiah, or the Simon Magus, or Simon Magus himself, one of the great Gnostics. He loses his temper in the Clementine and declaims, I am Christ, I am the creator of the world. Simon Magus, who appears in the New Testament and argues with Peter. So, as it says here, If any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, or there is Christ, believe him not. For in those days shall also false Christs arise. Notice he's talked about false messiahs before among the Jews, using the same word for both, you see. There'll be false messiahs among the Jews, false Christs among the Jews, and false Christs also after that, which is what happened. There shall be also false Christs arise and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders. Oh, they were good at that. Marcus, the Marcosian, for example, Apollonius. Tricks they do. Fire-breathing, you had sulfur in a walnut and things like that, and special magic tricks. One of his great ones was turning water to wine, turning to blood and then back to water again. It was a well-known magician's trick. But he'd pour out the white liquid and then it would turn red, and it was, oh, a transformation, a miracle, and so forth. They were doing those things right in the time of the apostles. And you can get that especially they mostly got together in Irenaeus. Shall false Christs and false prophets and show great signs and wonders insomuch that, if possible, they shall deceive the very elect, who are the elect according to the covenant. Then, behold, I speak these to you for the elect's sake. It's to encourage them. This is why, you see, because this is not good news. And when these things, here the Lord has come, he's brought the glad message, he's founded the church and so forth, why should things go bad? Why doesn't anything turn out happily? Why doesn't this have a happy ending? He says, I don't want you to be discouraged. I'm telling you these things ahead of time so that you won't be upset when they happen and say, well, it's false, and leave the church and so forth. And people expect sudden blessings now. You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all I have told you must come to pass, but the end is not yet. So don't let it upset you too much. You expect the wars and so forth, and the end isn't yet. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, this is very important, because this is a touch that didn't come out until the 1940s, until 1948, as a matter of fact, when they discovered desert sectaries crawling all over the place with the Dead Sea Scrolls. These sectaries, they would go out in the time of John the Baptist and in the time of Christ, they were there. Numbers of them, the Damascus Covenanters and the Qumran communities, but Rakim, people all over the place, that would form these conventicles waiting for the Lord to come, and their leaders would claim to be messiahs and so forth. And it says here, wherefore, if they shall say unto you, notice this, behold, he is in the desert, and that's what they did. They left Jerusalem when it was destroyed. The Jews weren't allowed to stay there, you see, after the year 70, and then after the year 130, no Jew was allowed to go there at all. So they went Pella in the desert. A very interesting place to visit today, out in Jordan, Pella, and made that their capital. And they went to all these desert places, but he says, don't go into the desert. You're not going to find the church out there. You won't find them anywhere, he says. If anybody says he's a Christ, don't believe him, he says. They're false Christ. There won't be anyone qualified. Behold, he's in the secret chambers, again, these secret conventicles that met in Jerusalem and elsewhere in secret. If they didn't flee to the desert, they could hide out. Famous Hadrian's transcript, rescript of the Emperor Hadrian on such conventicles in Asia Minor. He says, don't believe it. Now, if you're looking for the gospel, this is what to look for. This is what will be found. And then we come to the restoration here. For as the light of the morning, this is how it's going to be. For as the light of the morning cometh out of the east and shineth to the west, and covereth the whole earth, this is added, and it's very important, so also shall the coming of man be. The gospel will spread in this manner. As the sun comes, gradually, imperceptibly, it spreads, but rapidly. I say gradually, but rapidly. I'm going to give you a parable how it will be, he says. And this is the one that puzzles so many people because it sounds so unpleasant to compare the elect gathering into the church to a carcass, to a rotting corpse in the desert. But the purpose of every image or parable or metaphor is to emphasize one particular point right across the way here in the 47th verse. He says the Lord will come as a thief in the night. Well, does that mean he's going to come to rob people, that he's going to come over the wall, he's going to be sneaky, he's going to be dishonest? Of course. No, it means he comes in the manner in which a thief comes, takes you by surprise, when you're not expecting. In that sense, he'll come, in that sense only. And we get the same thing here. And so here he says, behold, I will show you. Wherever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. And then this very important, that's all the New Testament says. What do you mean, wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together? That isn't a pleasant image or anything else. So we have to be told here, so likewise shall mine elect be gathered from the four quarters of the earth. All right, what happens when there's a carcass in the desert? When there's something like, or anywhere else? The eagles come, or the vultures, or the buzzards, or whatever they're going to be, from all directions. All of a sudden, they appear out of nowhere. It's quite miraculous to see. How do they know? How can they see? Their eyesight is absolutely fabulous. From miles away, you see the specks coming where the carcass is. They gather in a mysterious way from all directions in a way that can't be explained. This is the way the saints are going to be gathered in the last day. First, the light breaks in the east. We have that hymn, the morning breaks, the shadows flee. The light breaks in the east, as in that manner, you see. Doesn't necessarily have to be the east. Oh, how they argued about that east business. Well, what do you mean by the east? Did it come from the Orient? No, not necessarily. I'm talking about how the light begins. It always begins in the east, in the dawn, you know. So that's the way it is, and spreads in that manner, it says, and covereth the whole west. For as the light of the morning comes out of the east, that's the manner in which these things will take place. And then, just the people will be gathered together to Zion how? In the same manner, the same miraculous manner in which the eagles are gathered together to an object nobody else can see. So likewise shall they be gathered. But it'll be a bad time, unfortunately. Now, wait a minute. Verses 1 to 20 is the end of Jerusalem. Verses 20 to 25 are the fate of the Christians and the sectaries. The sectaries are those in the desert and those in the secret conventicles, I say. They were very common. And now we come to verses 26 and 27 describing the Reformation in this metaphor, this parable, emphasizing the one point, the way in which it comes, the way in which it spreads, and the way in which the gathering takes place. And the circumstances under which they take place, which are very unpleasant, of course. Verses 28 to 31 describe the bad times of the Restoration, the times we live in, the time of the gospel being restored. They shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. And again, it's important that Joseph Smith asks, don't let these wars and rumors of wars make you think that the Lord has failed in his purposes, or that the purpose in restoring this glorious work is just to lead the war into a bathos of war and trouble. No, I speak for mine elect's sake. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places. Do you notice that in the year 1985, 10,000 children a day died of hunger in Africa? That's pretty good, you know. That's real famine. Never heard anything like that. And all the troubles and the earthquakes, what's happened this week, 3 earthquakes in San Francisco, and stuff like that. They're piling up. There are many, statistically, they've kept a chart over in the geology department here of frequency, and they're just piling up at an alarming rate. Well, and again, because of iniquity, we're getting plenty of that. Notice again, this is the second time. It happened in those ancient times. Now it's happening in the final time, both among the Christians and the Jews now. And again, because iniquity shall abound, for that reason, the love of many shall wax cold. A wicked person doesn't have true love in him. A person who is lecherous and vile, evil, dishonest, and so forth, naturally his love waxes cold. He can't deal with people the way he does and live with himself unless he takes a very cool, calm, and detached view of everything. But he that shall not be overcome, the same shall be saved. That's important. By this wickedness, notice. He shall not be overcome, by this wickedness shall be saved. And again, the gospel of the kingdom shall be preached unto all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come, or the destruction of the wicked. But not yet, you see. The gospel has to be preached to all the world. Well, it hasn't quite yet, as far as that goes. But this is the... Then we have the horma. Then we have the desolation again. And again shall abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet be fulfilled. These verses are all different numbers from those you find in the King James. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, after the big bump, after we get over at the other side of the bang, then what's happened? Then is going to have the tribulation of those days, then is going to happen this phenomenon, you see. The sun shall be darkened. Well, what would darken the sun? Except something in the atmosphere. And the moon shall not give her light. The moon blocked out entirely. Something in the atmosphere. Well, let you guess what. The stars shall fall from the heaven. Then meteoric showers and the like. Remember, a star is any shining object in the sky, as far as that goes. And the powers of heaven shall be shaken. The sky shall be dark, and it looks something like nuclear winter, you know, if you want to look at it that way. Verily I say unto you, this generation which shall see these things, in which these things shall be shown forth, notice these things come all rather close together, shall not pass away until all I have told you shall be fulfilled. There will be a post-nuke age then. Although the days will come, that heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away, but all shall be fulfilled. But this isn't the time when heaven and earth shall pass away, as he tells us in the last verse. He's talking about something else there. Well, and so we have the restoration and then the bad times, verses 28 to 31, then 31 to 37, the great destruction again, with the fearful process, section 88, by which this takes place. These things are described in section 88 in the same vivid language, very fully here. That's a good one to look up. As I said before, after the tribulation of these days, the powers of heaven shall be shaken, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn. Now, this is world affliction. The whole earth is smitten now. There's never been a war, destruction like that. All the tribes of the earth, the inhabitants, wherever they are, they will all be mourning, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of glory with power and of heaven, with power and great glory. But notice, the Son of Man, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn. This is something that covers the whole earth. You see, the Book of Mormon says that there will be a vapor of smoke and it shall cover the earth. Vapor of smoke will cover the earth. You know, these things are going to happen. We're determined on it right now. But whoso treasureth up my word shall not be deceived, for the Son of Man shall come. See, people will say, well, he's not coming. These times are too terrible. We're having no good news at all. Shall come. He shall send his angels before him with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together the remainder of his elect to the 4 years. The remainder is added there. Not gather together the elect, the remainder of his elect from the four winds, just like the gathering of the carcass there, from one end of heaven to the other. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. Now here again, you see, this is important, verses 38 to 40. How about the timing of this thing? He says there are no clocks, there are no stopwatches, but there are indicators. You can tell when, well, good in economics, you have market indicators. You can't be specific, you can't set figures and so forth, but there are indicators of which way the market will go and this, that, and the other. In the same way, the Lord says, I'll give you indicators how you can know where you stand in this thing and how things are going. But don't try to time it, because see, that's dangerous. If you say, as he tells us a little later here, if you say, I know exactly when he's going to come, well, then we can enjoy ourselves for 10 minutes until 10 minutes before, and then we'll be ready. If we know the general's coming to inspect, we can clean up the barracks and make everything perfect before he comes. But it's the surprise inspection that catches you as you really are. This is where you, and that's what the Lord's going to do. He says here he's going to come as a thief in the night and catch you the way you really are. So don't try to prepare for this. And this is very important when he talks about this destruction. Boy, I'm going to get on here. So likewise, mine elect, when you shall see these things, you shall know that he is near, even at the doors, Mark 13 here. So, but the day and the hour, but of the day and the hour, no one knoweth. See, no calendars, no clock's going to do you any good. Don't try to predict it that way. No, not the angels of God in heaven, but my Father only, Luke 17 and 22 there. But business as usual is the theme now. So don't, things may be going pretty well as far as that goes. As it was in the days of Noah, this is the way it went, so it shall be also at the coming of the Son of Man. For in this Luke 17, 22 following, he adds another thing. He says they were buying, they were selling, they were giving in marriage, they were marrying, they were eating, they were drinking. All the normal activities of life were going on. It was business as usual, and then the flood came and hit them like that. And that's the way it's going to be. So you can't tell by those signs, he says. The days of Noah, for until the day that Noah entered into the ark, right? They were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, and Luke says them buying and selling. And they knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also be the coming of the Son of Man, all of a sudden. Then shall be fulfilled that which is written, that in the last days, now this is, how do you prepare for this? How did he tell the Jews to prepare? He says, flee to the mountains, hide in the caves. They got out that way. But don't go back to Jerusalem. Well, that's exactly the way it happened. What do we do now? How do you prepare for this? Do you hide in a cave? Do you build yourself a shelter? The Lord says, it's not going to do you any good at all. That is not the way you prepare this time, he says. As it is written, two shall be in the field, and one shall be taken, and one left. There are no survival schemes. Which one? They're equally prepared or equally expecting. Two women, the New Testament says, two women shall be grinding at the mill, two women in the kitchen, it says. One is taken, and the other is spared. How can you figure? They're side by side, the two women, and this is certainly, it happens that way in wartime, too. You never know who. And what I say to you, I say unto all men, so what can you do about it, you see? Don't prepare ahead of time and say, I'm going to be perfectly safe. I got a plan that will make me perfectly safe. No, two together in the same situation, One is taken, the other spared, and there's no way they can calculate which one it'll be. But there is a way, he said. I'm going to tell you how, what you should do, and this is the plan of procedure. This is the direction. No strategies for survival. They're not going to do any good. But from 46 to 54 now, he's going to tell us what should be done. Instructions for the saints here. First of all, you watch. You act as if the Lord were coming all the time. See, if the barracks are in spick and span condition all the time, then you don't worry about inspection. That's the way it is. Watch, therefore, for you know not at the hour your Lord shall come. There's nothing you can do about that. But know this. If the good man had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up, but would have been ready. All right. If you knew when the Lord was coming, you had been watching and you'd been make special preparations to receive him. But since you don't know, the only thing to do is to be prepared all the time, as if he was coming any moment. Tomorrow, that's what he says, because he will come as a thief in the night. Therefore, be ye also ready, for in such an hour ye think not the Son of Man cometh. The only answer is to be ready all the time. And then he says, well, then how are you ready all the time? The next verse he says, 49th. Who then is a faithful and a wise servant, whom his Lord hath made ruler over his house, to give them meat in due season. Notice, he has made them ruler over his house. The ruler is supposed to take care of the rest of the household. He is the dominus. He is the Lord. That's what both those words mean. Dominus means Lord of the house, and Laford means keeper of the loaf, of course. So he says the same thing here. The servant who's been appointed must be responsible and take care toward his fellow man. Blessed is that servant who, when his Lord cometh, shall be found doing so well. And verily I say unto you, he shall make him ruler over his goods. But if that evil servant shall say on his heart, here it is, see, my Lord delayeth his coming, he's not coming, I'm safe for quite a while at least. See, if you knew when he was coming, you could say that. My Lord delayeth his coming, this is what is likely. He'll begin to smite his fellow servants and to eat and drink and be drunken and take advantage of them and be cruel and greedy and all the things that people are when they don't expect the Lord to really to be coming for quite a while. Remember, Book of Mormon, he'll beat us with a few stripes and then everything will be all right. The Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him. He's going to be surprised. And in an hour that he's not aware of. But this is what you're supposed to do, is to behave toward your fellow man in the manner the Lord would have you. If he was here himself, in Zion, what we should be like in Zion. As you get in that writing of President Kimball's. Incidentally, I have some copies of those for any that didn't get them. And I'm going to give the subject now for the final. So you can, since it's the 11th of April, it'll give you 10 days to think about it. And I think it's a good subject, we'll see. And shall cut him asunder and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. Now the hypocrites again, therefore weeping and wailing and gnashing teeth. Now this is important, notice the last verse. This is not the end of the world as people conceive it. Thus cometh the end of the wicked, according to the prophecy of Moses, saying, they shall be cut off from among the people. But the end of the earth, now he uses a geological term, cosmological, scientific, the earth, the planet. That's not the end of the planet. This isn't the time when the earth will be vaporized, the heavens rolled up as a scroll. That's another thing. He says, when does that come? That doesn't concern you now, as he tells Moses, but by and by. Notice the last thing. Thus cometh the end of the wicked, according to the prophecy of Moses, saying, they shall be cut off from among the people. But the end of the earth isn't yet. We're not talking about that at all. That's by and by. But these are the ends that will concern you. And this is the end that concerns us. Now, we have... the next time we'll review the whole thing, still, I think, it would give us more time to think about it if we consider this. Some have been worried about assignments here, and... you notice I've passed over the Pearl of Great Price lightly, actually, the books of the Pearl of Great Price rather lightly, the assignment being for you to read them more carefully along the lines indicated. Of course, that's what you sound, because it's a short enough book, after all. It's a short book, but a great one, and you're justified in spending a lot of time with it, and you can... And that's a standing assignment. I don't know that any more should be necessary. And notice I have deliberately omitted the most important book of all. Yes. Kimball's updating the Joseph Smith story, the last one of the lot, the last of the dispensations. That's 156 years ago now. What's happened? Well, President Kimball is bringing us to date on the present situation. And so I deliberately left that out, and because I've been saving that for the big assignment, because this is it. The essay due on April 11th by 6 p.m. That's when it is due. This is the subject, and the essay will be judged as an essay, of course. And I think the subject is glaringly obvious in that, in view of that. And it is, yeah. How does the Pearl of Great Price, unless you want to make changes, how does the Pearl of Great Price testify to the mission of Joseph Smith? You notice it can be philosophically, historically, literary, religious, documentary, scientific. See all those things about creation and so forth. How does the Pearl of Great Price testify to the mission? Because the mission of Joseph Smith, remember, this is the last book in the Pearl of Great Price. Do they all begin together, belong together in the same book? How do they support each other? And above all, notice there's so many points of view here. There's so many angles in which you could treat this thing that you should take some time to think about it. Read through the Pearl of Great Price if you've never read it before, and ask yourself, it finally culminates. You see, here we come with the Lord. He gives us the three dispensations, the times of wickedness and vengeance, just as has been put down in the days of Enoch. And he tells us about that time of wickedness and vengeance, then the time against the Christian, the long apostasy. First, the destruction of Jerusalem, a horrible thing, then the apostasy, then the restoration. But it doesn't say, then the, remember, this was given right, this was given at a very early time. It doesn't say, well, now the gospel's restored. This time it'll be different. This time everything is going to be beautiful. Because the gospel's restored, the prophet Joseph's come worse than ever. And that's a remarkable thing, isn't it? See, when was this given? The I have to ask the candidate when this was given. Do you have it in your? Well, it doesn't make any difference. We know it was before. We know, well, this is 1838. This one was the 1838 one, but there, in 1969, they discovered one much older than this that was written in the handwriting of Frederick G. Williams, which the prophet dictated when he was 26 years old, and it's a much better account than this one. But this one is the one they chose to publish here because they didn't have that one. That wasn't was discovered until 69. And that was printed in the BYU studies in the spring of 1969, along with all other versions, five different versions of the first vision. Very important to fill out the picture there. And you can still get that 1969 issue, the gray issue with a picture of Joseph Smith on the front of it. But this is the theme of the whole thing. This would answer everything else. As far as the big question is concerned, where do we find our comfort and so forth? What joy is there in this? What is the reassurance of the gospel? Well, of course, the big question we were talking about all the time, the earlier part, was actually the problem, what's hereafter? What's coming? Are we going into the dark and so forth? And if anyone answered that, of course, it's Joseph Smith. And did he answer it? And does this give us reason for confidence in his mission and so forth?